He has been at the University of Michigan. He's been at Yale University. He has developed an everyday discrimination scale that is one of the most widely cited and used measures of discrimination in health studies. He has more than 300 scientific papers, which makes me impressed that he found time to come and visit with us. He is an elected member of the Institute of Medicine and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He has served on basically every committee you can imagine. His bio sketch, you know, that's supposed to be that little small bio sketch, is actually longer than my own personal CV. He is one impressive fellow, and I'm still looking forward to hearing what he has to say. So, Dr. Williams.
Well, thank you, and you've just been hired as my political campaign manager.
Yeah.
As long as you all vote next week, it's fine.
Okay.
This is the second microphone.
Which is the microphone that's recording the session?
There's one here. So we should,
yeah.
So we should have this one here also.
Yeah.
All right. So what I'll try to do today is, in the time we have, just to highlight some methodological issues that I think is important for us to think about as we think about disparities and understanding them, and also some key conceptual issues that I think become very important to that enterprise. The first issue I want to raise is that there are some methodological issues that many of us seldom think about linked to how racial ethnic status is measured, analyzed, and or presented that affect our knowledge of actually even the existence and magnitude of racial ethnic disparities in health. And I'll show some examples of this by using national data. So this is national data from National Center for Health Statistics, age-adjusted mortality rates for the United States, with whites as the comparison group of one, showing that African Americans have a 30% higher death rate than whites, and all other racial ethnic groups have lower death rates than that of whites. American Indians, Asian Pacific Islanders, and Hispanics are all lower than whites. I think to understand the issue I'm going to raise, we need to understand what I'm calling the limits of age adjustment. Now, age adjustment is a very useful strategy. I'm not speaking against age adjustment. It's routine. It's widely used. It's a statistical procedure that has enormous value in terms of trying to ensure we can compare apples with apples. I define what the age-adjusted rate is here, weighted average of age-specific rates, with the weights being determined by the age structure of the age standard. There is dramatic variation in the age structure of the major racial and ethnic populations in the United States. It's a completely reasonable, appropriate scientific thing for us to do age adjustment. The question is, what does age adjustment tell us, and when should we use it, and for what purposes should we use it? National Center for Health Statistics, in the footnote of their report, indicates that age-adjusted rates are relative indices for comparison, but are not actual measures of risk. But if you look at the press releases from NCHS, and you look at how most researchers use age-adjusted data, they use them as if they were actual measures of risk, and they're not. And I think we get a very different picture. So to illustrate the different picture we got, I'm going to take same data, NCHS data, for the same year. Remember, African Americans, the only group with a higher rate, and it's only 30% higher. Here is minority-white mortality ratios. The whites are one, so you can see that African Americans and American Indians in early life have higher death rates than that of whites. In midlife, have markedly higher death rates. You can see the increase for blacks is almost twice as high for African Americans. Into the older age group, you see, remember, whites are one. You can see by age 65 to 74, American Indians have come to the same level where whites are, and African Americans do that at age 85. So let's review what we just saw. In contrast to an age-adjusted rate that's 30% higher for African Americans, age-specific rates indicate that the rates are at least twice as high as those of whites, black rates, between ages 1 through 4 and 25 to 54. That is, through most of the life course, the rates are twice as high, and are more than 40% higher at ages 5 to 24 and 55 to 74. So the 30% higher rate really gives you a very distorted view of the real excess level of ill health for the African-American population. For American Indians, in contrast to an age-adjusted mortality rate that is lower than that of whites, death rates are higher than those of the white population, ages 1 through 4, 15 to 64, and equivalent ages 5 to 14, 65 to 74. Again, you would walk away from the age-adjusted data that there's no problem in Indian country. You get a very different story by looking at age-specific death rates. For Latinos, in contrast, an age-adjusted rate that is lower than that of whites, you can see mortality rates that are comparable to those of whites up through age 14, slightly even higher in young adulthood, but lower beyond age 35. I'm going to come back to other problems with the Latino data in a minute. And for the Asian Pacific Islander population, the age-adjusted data and the age-specific data tell us, in fact, the same story. A couple other points I think are important to put the national mortality data into perspective, especially when we focus on specific population. The national data for American Indians doesn't capture the excess risk well for American Indians served by the Indian Health Service, which is 60% of that population. And here's IHS service area data, and you can see the pronounced excess risk twice as high through most of the life course for American Indians served by the Indian Health Service. I want to illustrate another issue about the age adjustment standard that sometimes we seldom think about. There are a lot of numbers on this chart, but let me try to illustrate them really quickly. So what I'm doing here is using published NCHS data and showing the difference that the age standard makes. So for up through 1998, for about decades, the National Center for Health Statistics used the 1940 standard million as the age adjustment standard. And then that was changed to the 2000 standard million. So what they've done, it's the age-adjusted standard at one level, is arbitrary. They're using a different age adjustment standard. What I'm illustrating here is the difference you obtain in terms of both the absolute and relative black-white differences in mortality from 1950 to 1998, just depending on which age adjustment standard you use. And the conclusions would be different as to what's happening with disparities over time, just linked to which age adjustment standard is used. So if you look here, the age adjustment, the 1940 standard million, which was the age adjustment standard used for a while, you could see that the absolute differences, the black-white differences, 4.4 per thousand in 1950 is 2.4 per thousand in 1998. So you'd say at an absolute level, disparities are reduced. They're about half what they used to be in 1950. Relatively, no change, 1.5 times higher in 1950, 1.5 times higher in 1998. Currently, NCHS uses the 2000 standard million. This is the same data with a different standard million. If we say what has happened with the absolute differences, 3.1 per 1,000 deaths in 1950, 2.9 in 1998, instead of saying it's half, about half of what it used to be, there's been very little change. And if we look at the relative difference, 20% higher in 1950, 30% higher in 1998. So it's the same data, two different stories on absolute difference and relative difference, just linked to the age adjustment standard. And I'm just saying we need to be a lot more thoughtful about our conclusions about disparities and recognize some of the limitations of the standards. I think an issue that I don't have a lot of time to talk about is that we need to pay attention to which measure of inequalities we use. There's a wonderful paper in the Milbank Quarterly about this some time ago. If we only use relative measures, we will understate some of the progress that has been made. So to give you one quick example in passing, the relative racial black-white difference in infant mortality is larger today than it was in 1950. But at an absolute level, the disparity is much smaller today than it was in 1950. So I think which measure you use will lead to different conclusions. A couple other issues we should keep in mind when we think of national mortality data and some of its strengths and limitations is the problem of census undercount. Most of the denominators for the mortality rates I've been talking about comes from the census. The census gives us the denominator, the population at risk. That's absolutely fine. The question is, how accurate is the measure of the population at risk? Census estimates that they don't count all groups of the population equally well. You could see that the census estimates they count white females perfectly. There's no undercount. of white females, but there is an undercount of small of white males, a pretty substantial one of African-American males, and a small undercount of black females. Importantly, what I'm illustrating here is, look at the, in the middle years, between about age 35 to age 54, census estimates, and this is an estimate of the undercount, and we can talk about how good the estimate is. There's a committee from the American Statistical Association thinks these estimates are not as good as they used to be. But the census estimates indicate that they are missing about 16%, 16 to 19% of the black middle-aged population in the United States. What's the significance of that? If you calculate a rate and use a denominator with an undercount in the denominator, mathematically, the rate calculated is overestimated in exact proportion to the degree of undercount. So if the undercount, the denominator has a 15% undercount, then the rate you have obtained is 15% too high, which means that virtually all the statistics you've ever heard about middle-aged black males is higher than they actually are. One other important point about that is that the census estimate of undercount is available at the national level. They do not provide undercount estimates for different metropolitan areas or different cities, and if the estimate for black males 40 to 44 is 18.7%, almost 19%, you could imagine it's much larger in New York and Chicago and some of the big cities. So when you look at HIV rates for these cities, death rates, you know, again, what the degree of undercount is, we don't know. So that's just another point that we should be well aware. These things are all well footnoted in government reports, but no one reads the footnotes. Let's talk about a numerator problem that we should also be aware of. One of the things I consistently say is that the nationally reported mortality data is more accurate for blacks and whites than for the other populations. And one of the reasons for that is the numerator problem. Where do numerators come from? The number of deaths. We get that from the death certificate. Well, who puts that information in the death certificate? Typically the funeral home director. How does that person assess the race of the person? Typically looks at a corpse and determines what race that person is and records it on the death certificate. How good are we at looking at someone and telling what race they are? Pretty good for blacks and whites, not good for other racial ethnic groups in the United States. So here is an example of a study done by Paul Sorley and colleagues, which looks at the race that people reported they were in the current population survey and the race reported for them on the death certificate. So you're looking at a direct match. What race did people say they were when they were alive? What race is reported on the death certificate? And you see, for whites, we're doing pretty well. 99%, right. For blacks, about 2% of persons who said they were black are recorded as something else on the death certificate. For American Indians, it's 26%. For Asian Pacific Islanders, it's 17%. And most of the discrepancy is persons who reported a different race that are recorded on the death certificate as white. So that's why I have this column of misrepresentation as white. For Hispanics, it's about 10% overall, but it varies by Hispanic population. The key point then, it means that the nationally reported estimates, particularly for American Indians, as well as for Asians and Latinos, are in fact lower than the actual race because they've missed this numerator problem of not counting accurately. There's other evidence that suggests that if you compare population-based prospective studies of the Latino population and compared to the national estimates, you get higher levels of risk of cardiovascular disease, for example, from the population-based studies than you get from the national data linked to some of the problems of the data systems that we have. Another quick issue I want to talk about is the central role that migration plays in understanding health, and therefore the critical need when we study populations, particularly those that have a large migrant component, to report data by nativity status and migration status, because if we don't, we will get a distorted view of what the health status is of those populations. Here is, I'm drawing on a paper by Kestner et al., looking at allostatic load, a measure of biological dysregulation across multiple systems, and here the data for two different age groups, for blacks, whites, and Mexicans. U.S. born is the further column, and then here is for foreign-born Mexicans by length of stay in the United States. Basically, the point I want to make is that foreign-born Mexicans who are in the U.S. for 10 years or less have a biological profile similar to whites. Those who have been here for 21 years or more have a biological profile virtually identical to that of U.S.-born Mexicans, and those two Mexican groups have a profile similar to African Americans. So that from a health point of view, there's other data that shows the same thing. Mexican immigrants begin, in terms of health, similar to whites, but by 21 years in the United States, their profile is similar to African Americans. A dramatic worsening in the health status of populations. Here is another example of the same thing, different outcome. Prevalence of psychiatric disorder, and you can see for first generation, second generation, third generation, for black Caribbean immigrants in the United States, first generation, low, second generation, huge jump, third generation, the single most disadvantaged group we've seen in psychiatric disorder studies in the U.S. Similar pattern for Latinos, not quite as steep a rise. For Asians, you see a jump from the first to the second generation. So again, paying attention to nativity status and generational status, critical to understand patterns for these populations. As we understand what are the drivers, so I've talked about some of the things that tells us the descriptive profile of the health of these populations. As we seek to understand what are the drivers of the health of U.S.-based populations, in addition to race, we know that socioeconomic status is important, and we need to think of race and socioeconomic status together. Just quickly, I'm showing national heart disease mortality, the number one killer in the United States. For black and white men, the pattern is the same for women, and at different levels of education. And what the green bar shows is the gap. And so you can see there's a large gap at every level of education. So when you've adjusted for socioeconomic status, there is something else about race that's driving health that we really need to seek to understand. The pattern is the same for women. In the interest of time, I'm going to move on quickly. Why does race still matter so much? Why are there racial differences at every level of socioeconomic status? Four reasons. Touching them. All of them are important. Focusing on one of them alone is not enough. Socioeconomic status indicators are not equivalent. Stress matters a lot. Racism and discrimination matters a lot. And you need to take the life course into account. Health of adults is shaped not only by their current socioeconomic status, but by what they face over the life course. Some quick examples. This is from Tanya Lewis's work showing the mean visceral fat. This is the bad kind of abdominal fat that is obtained through imaging data. By everyday discrimination. The higher the level of everyday discrimination, the higher the level of abdominal fat. Discrimination is literally making people fat, is what this shows. And this is true for black and white women in Tanya Lewis's work. Place matters a lot. An illustration of place matters a lot. Mississippi stands out as a state in the United States with the highest rates of heart disease for blacks and whites in the country. Here, the rate for white women, for black women, and when you put the two together and you look at the distribution, what you see, there's absolutely no overlap in the distribution. The white women who are doing worse in Mississippi, in the state where all whites are doing worse, are still doing better than the black women who are doing the best. Statistically, there's a problem because how do you control? There's no overlap in the distribution. Residential segregation, a powerful driver of these differences. It is distinctive for African Americans. And importantly, this is a conceptual issue, we have not really thought long and hard of what that means. If there's groups that are heavily segregated, it means they're living under different environmental conditions. Biology is not static. It is adaptive to the environmental exposures that individuals have. So we should expect to find biological profiles that are different for blacks compared to other groups. And if we see a profile difference, it doesn't mean it's a genetic difference, but there are adaptive responses to the exposures that they have. Research on race and genetics has focused heavily on gene frequency differences, and we really need to focus much more on gene expression differences, or epigenetics refers to changes in the pattern of gene expression linked to multiple factors, but one of them is linked to environmental exposures. And therefore, when you look at groups living under very different environmental conditions, we should expect to find epigenetic differences. a striking pattern, just to illustrate the potential of looking at some of these complexities, is the relationship between alcohol and health. By the way, tobacco shows the same pattern, where a given level of substance has a much more negative impact on African Americans compared to whites. And we don't know what that reflects. Does that reflect interactions between the exposure, alcohol, and social, physical, chemical stressors? Does it reflect gene expression differences? Does it reflect we've misunderstood the moderate alcohol consumption and health association? How do we make sense of these differences? It's the kind of work we need to do. I think we are also in a window of opportunity where we are in the middle of a difficult economic time and could help us well-designed studies to shed light on the complex relationship between economic status and health. A report from the Pew Research Council shows that between 2005 and 2009, both blacks and Latinos have had dramatic declines in wealth, so that today whites have 20 times more wealth on average than African Americans. That's another way of saying that for every dollar of wealth whites have, blacks have 5 cents. And 18 times more wealth than Latinos. And finally, I want to talk a little bit about intersectionality. I think we pay little attention to this, but complex patterns emerge when we think of multiple social status categories together. In our real lives, they are simultaneous. You're male and of a particular racial group and a particular level of socioeconomic status. And intersectionality and health has enormous impact. Let me give you just some quick examples. So here is life expectancy data for the United States, 1950 to the present. There's a 5-year gap in 1950 compared to the gap in 2006 compared to the gap in 1950. Let's look at changes in life expectancy by race, gender group. And some intriguing questions now emerge. What we find is the group that has had the largest gain in life expectancy since 1950 is African-American women. Actually, African-American women have higher life expectancy than white males, have had higher life expectancy than white males since 1970. You heard me right. I didn't mistake. Black women have lived longer than white men in the United States since 1970. It raises a whole new question. What's responsible for the success of African-American? Why have they done so well? It raises enormous new questions. Here's another example. National data for the United States. Smoking rates for black and white women, they're identical. You say no disparity, nothing more we need to do. Let's look at the differences by income at the same time. And you see at every level of income, black women have lower rates of smoking. Racism changes the question of what are the drivers of these lower rates of smoking within the African-American female population. Another example. The black-white mortality ratio for lung cancer death rates, the number one cause of cancer deaths in the United States. You heard me right. Lung cancer kills more American women than breast cancer does each year. The black-white ratio is 1.09 for males, 0.76 for females. Let's look at the same data by race and SES and gender together. You see at the lower levels of education, white men actually have higher risk of lung cancer than black men. At a higher level of education, the opposite is true, and the same is true for women. Markedly higher risk for white women at the lower levels of education, and higher risk modestly for black women at the higher levels. The point of paying attention to this intersectionality is important. Two last points. We need to pay attention to the continuum of disease. There are not only higher rates of illness, but there's greater severity of illness. There's the poorer course of illness, and we need to understand the determinants at every level across the continuum of disease. We need to develop new models that capture not the linear independent relationships, but there's the clustering of these risk factors and the clustering of chronic disease in populations, and we really need models to really try to capture that. Hopefully the next speaker with models may help us with that. I don't know. We didn't coordinate. And finally, my final slide, what we really need is a more integrated science that will help us to better understand how multiple dimensions of the social and physical environment combine, and they combine some of them additively, some interactively with each other, and with innate and acquired biological factors, and accumulate over the life course that affects the onset of illness and the progression of disease. And that's the kind of research agenda that will really shed light on helping us to understand what drives health disparities in the United States. Thank you so very much.